Imagine for a second that you go out and buy a brand new multi-hundred-dollar appliance. Like, let's say it's a high-end car.
Okay,
You
sure.
bring it home, you park it in your garage, and you decide you want to pop the hood to, tweak the engine a bit.
Right, just to see how it works or maybe get some more horsepower out of it.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe make it run a little faster. And in a normal world, sure, you might void your warranty doing that.
Absolutely.
But the car itself is just a machine, right? It just sits there and lets you turn the wrench.
Right, it doesn't fight back.
Exactly. It doesn't fight back. But now, imagine if the moment you touch that engine with a wrench, the car's internal computer deliberately surged electricity to, I don't know, melt its own spark plugs?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Or it disabled its cooling systems so the engine block would literally fracture from the heat.
Jeez.
And then, on top of all that, it permanently reported your license plate to a global blacklist so you could never drive on a public road again.
That is a rather intense scenario to picture for a morning commute. But honestly, it perfectly encapsulates the shift we are seeing in modern consumer electronics right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're talking about the transition from passive ownership to what is effectively, well, a hostile architecture.
And that hostile architecture is sitting under a lot of our TVs right now. So today's deep dive is all about ninth generation video game consoles.
Right, specifically the PlayStation 5 and the Xbox Series X and S.
Exactly. We are diving into this massive August 27, 2026 technical dossier. It was published by Teekin Game Media, and it's titled Deconstructing Console Security Architectures and Modern DRM.
Which is a heavy title, but a fantastic read.
Oh, it really is. The editorial board actually gave this report a 9.8 out of 10 for security mastery. And I have to say, just reading through these notes, it is equal parts fascinating and honestly slightly terrifying.
I mean, the stakes have never been higher for the hardware inside those plastic boxes.
Yeah.
And the boundary between actual computer engineering and, wild internet hyperbole is constantly blurred on social media.
Oh, constantly.
People read a sensationalized headline about a console being a ticking time bomb, and they just take it as gospel.
Yeah.
So we really need to strip away the panic and look at the bare metal today.
Okay, so let's start right there at the metal. Because if I'm listening to this, I'm probably wondering, why do Sony or Microsoft care so much about me modding a box that I paid $500 for?
Right.
Why go to such extremes? And more importantly, how is this different from a standard PC? Because if I buy a gaming rig, I can install Linux, I can swap the motherboard, I can literally do whatever I want.
That's the open ecosystem of a PC.
Right. But the Teekin Game dossier uses the phrase isolated topology to describe modern consoles. What does that actually mean in the real world?
Well, think about your standard open architecture PC. The main processor, the CPU, it does a bit of everything. It runs your games, it runs your web browser, and it also handles the system security checks. But in a modern console, that entire philosophy is just thrown out the window. The primary brain of the console, the heavy lifting by 86 cores that actually render the graphics and run the game logic, they are completely stripped of their security privileges.
Wait, really? So they are not in charge?
Exactly. They're basically just a very fast, very dumb worker.
So who is in charge then?
A completely separate, heavily fortified coprocessor. On the AMD chips used in these consoles, it is called the Platform Security Processor, or PSP.
Okay, PSP.
Yeah. Other systems might use an ARM TrustZone equivalent. But it's the same idea. This coprocessor operates completely independently of the game you're playing. It is the ultimate gatekeeper.
Wow.
And it establishes what engineers refer to as the hardware root of trust.
Okay, let's unpack this. Hardware root of trust. Because in the old days, like the PS3 or Xbox 360 era, if I wanted to hack a console, I was usually trying to trick the software.
Yeah, they have the standard battleground back then.
Ooh.
Older generations relied on primitive software hash verification.
Meaning what exactly?
Well, the system would look at a piece of code, run a mathematical formula to generate a unique fingerprint, which is called a hash. And if it matched the expected result, the system let the code run.
But software can be tricked, right? Like, if I can rewrite the rules of the operating system, I
Yeah.
can just tell the system, hey, this pirated game, its fingerprint is totally fine.
Precisely. Which is why the industry entirely abandoned software-only security.
Ah.
The hardware root of trust on a PS5 or Xbox Series console doesn't rely on software for its baseline security at all. It utilizes immutable cryptographic keys that are literally burned straight into the silicon die of the chip.
Wait. Burned into the physical chip? By who?
By a laser during manufacturing at the factory. etched into the silicon itself.
That is insane.
Yeah, you cannot alter them without taking an electron microscope and physically destroying the processor. So when you turn the console on, the PSP uses those physical, unchangeable keys to verify the digital signatures of every single piece of code trying to load. It is a full hardware-enforced hypervisor. If someone manages to find a loophole in a game's code, lateral movement into the protected system files is mathematically and physically blocked by the silicon itself.
So a normal PC is like an office building. If I find a side door that was left unlocked, I can just sort of wander into the CEO's office.
Right, yeah.
But a modern console is more like a high security vault.
Right.
The CEO's office is locked down, and there's a dedicated VIP bouncer, the PSP, who isn't just checking ID badges. He's checking DNA that literally can't be faked.
I can capture the dynamic perfectly, yes. And the bouncer isn't employed by the office building. He operates on his own entirely separate set of physical laws.
But wait, what happens when the console needs an update? Because, you know, Sony and Microsoft send out firmware updates all the time.
All the time, yeah.
So if the security is physically burned into the chip, how do they patch it? The dossier talks about something called e-fuses, and this conceptually just blew my mind.
Oh, electronic fuses are a fascinating piece of engineering. They are microscopic arrays of physical fuses located directly on the processor die.
Okay, so when I download a new firmware update over Wi-Fi, what is the console actually doing with those fuses?
It is sending a tiny, targeted surge of current to physically and permanently blow a specific set of those microscopic fuses.
It's literally burning the bridge so I can't go back.
In the most literal sense possible. They alter the physical state of the hardware. The reason is simple, really. If version 7.0 of the firmware has a massive security hole and the company patches it in version 8.0, they know hackers will try to force the console to downgrade back to version 7.0 to exploit that hole.
Right, that's how people used to jailbreak older consoles.
Exactly. But by blowing the e-fuse, the hardware bouncer now looks at version 7.0, sees that the physical fuse array no longer matches the software requirement, and immediately triggers a halt state.
So the system just refuses to boot.
It just stops. It won't even try to load. Even if the system crashes and boots into safe mode, the diagnostic environment is intensely constrained.
So I can't just plug in a USB drive with a custom operating system to fix it?
No, absolutely not. The PSP controller layer will only parse and flash cryptographically signed payloads directly from the vendor if it sees an unauthenticated binary.
Halt
state. Brick.
Okay, so the hardware is an impenetrable fortress that will literally burn its own bridges to keep me out. That is incredibly impressive engineering, I have to admit.
It really is an engineering marvel.
But if we follow that logic, it leads us to a really uncomfortable question. If the hardware is locked down this tightly and it's designed to halt everything if it detects an anomaly, what happens when it seemingly breaks itself? Because a few years ago, the entire internet was in an absolute panic over something called the C-bomb.
The CMOS battery clock bomb.
Yeah.
Yes, that was a moment of profound collective anxiety for the gaming community.
For anyone who maybe missed this, let me set the scene here. Inside these multi-hundred-dollar hyper-advanced consoles is a standard, cheap CR2032 coin cell battery.
The exact same battery you'd find in a basic digital watch, yeah.
Or a garage door opener. And its job is just to keep the internal clock ticking when the console is unplugged. But the rumor going around was that Sony and Microsoft had engineered an intentional kill switch.
Which was a terrifying prospect for consumers.
Totally. The theory was that when this cheap little battery eventually died, which all batteries do, it would permanently brick the console. You wouldn't be able to play digital games, and you wouldn't even be able to put a physical disc into the drive and play it offline. People thought they had purchased literal ticking time bombs.
Which is a perfect example of why reading the actual technical documentation is so vital. The community took a very real symptom and immediately ascribed malicious intent to it.
So what was actually happening?
Well, the engineering reality, as the Tech and Game report meticulously details, is that this was absolutely not an intentional DRM weapon. It was an oversight. Specifically, it was a flawed software timestamp validation logic tied to the trophy and achievement architecture.
Okay, I have to stop you there, because that makes zero sense to a layperson. Why would earning a digital trophy for, say, finding 100 hidden packages in a game cause my entire console to crash and refuse to read a physical disc?
I know, it sounds absurd.
Those two things seem completely unrelated.
On the surface, they are unrelated. What's fascinating here is that underneath, they share a dependency on the real-time clock, or RTC. When the early PS4 and PS5 firmware was written, the operating system required an authenticated network time handshake to actually award a trophy.
Meaning it had to ping a server over the internet to check the exact real-world time.
Yes. The developers wanted to prevent players from manually changing the clock on their console to cheat on timestamp leaderboards or, you know, bypass time-gated events in games.
Okay, that makes sense.
So the system relied on that little CMOS battery to keep the time calibrated locally and the server to verify it remotely.
Right, so what happens when the battery dies?
The internal clock loses its calibration. It resets to zero. Now, if your console is connected to the internet, it's fine. It just pings the server, gets the real time, and quietly updates itself.
But the problem arose when the battery was dead, and the console was air-gapped.
Exactly. Air-gapped meaning completely disconnected from the internet. In that specific state, when a player tried to launch a game, the operating system would attempt to initialize the trophy architecture. It would ask the real-time clock for the time.
And the clock would say, I have no idea, my battery is dead.
Exactly. And the console couldn't reach the internet to verify. This created what software engineers call an unhandled assertion failure during the game launch sequence.
An unhandled assertion failure, let's translate that, is that basically the console's operating system throwing its hands up in the air and saying, I don't have instructions for this scenario, so I'm just going to panic and shut down.
That is exactly the mechanism, yes. The code simply didn't have a pathway to proceed without a valid timestamp, so it crashed. It wasn't a deliberate mechanism to steal your games. It was an inadvertent design dependency on telemetry. A legacy coding error in the operating system layer.
But the way it got fixed is actually an amazing story of the community and the manufacturer working together, right?
It really is. In March 2021, independent hardware security researchers began publishing detailed disclosures. They didn't just complain on forums. They provided the actual mathematical proof that this RTC assertion failure was happening offline.
And by June 2021, forensic code analysis pinpointed that trophy timestamp loop as the exact culprit.
Which led directly to September 2021 when Sony issued official, permanent firmware fixes. Firmware 9.00 for the PS4 and the 21.02 SUO 4 update for the PS5.
So they completely decoupled the offline game execution from the clock synchronization.
Permanently. Today, you can take a brand new PS5 out of the box, rip the CMOS battery off the motherboard with a pair of pliers, never connected to Wi-Fi, and a physical disk will boot flawlessly.
That's awesome.
The C-bomb was defused. And, more importantly, it proved that the vendors never intended to obstruct offline playback. Constructive vulnerability disclosures led to a permanent resolution.
Okay, so the hardware fortress isn't designed to implode on its own. We've established that.
Right.
But hardware is only half the battle. If I'm a hacker and I know I can't beat the physical silicon keys or the e-fuses, my next logical step is to attack the game software itself. So how does the console protect the actual code running inside the memory? That leads us straight into one of the most debated names in modern gaming, de novo.
Oh, yes. Engineered by a company called Irdetto. And you are right to bring it up because it is vastly misunderstood by mainstream audiences.
Definitely. If you read gaming forums, people talk about de novo like it's a storefront login screen. They think it's the thing asking for their password when they launch a game or constantly checking their Wi-Fi.
But the Tekken Game Report stresses that it is emphatically not a traditional DRM system.
Exactly. It is not managing your digital rights or checking if you bought the game on a specific store. De novo is a highly specialized anti-tamper envelope.
Its sole purpose is to obfuscate the game's execution logic so that no one can reverse engineer the binary code.
And the mechanics of how it does this are, frankly, wild. The dossier refers to its method as dynamic custom virtual machine obfuscation.
Quite a mouthful.
Let's break that down. When a developer makes a game, de novo takes the most critical functions of that game, the core logic, and translates it into a non-standard bytecode.
And it does this dynamically. When you are playing the game, that translated code isn't just sitting statically on your hard drive. It is actively executed inside a transient, polymorphic virtual machine that lives entirely in the system's RAM.
Okay, I have to throw a flag on the play here. Polymorphic virtual machine, what is actually happening in my RAM when that is running?
Well, polymorphic means the structure is constantly shifting its shape and behavior.
So if I'm a pirate trying to crack this game, it's not like I'm picking a static padlock.
No, not at all.
It is more like I'm trying to read a highly classified book, but the text on the page is constantly translating itself into a brand new made-up language right in front of my eyes every few seconds.
The translating book analogy is incredibly apt. And to take it a step further, Denuvo utilizes aggressive runtime integrity triggers.
Meaning the book is watching me while I read it?
Yes. If unauthorized patchers, memory injection hooks, or debugging tools attempt to inspect those shifting memory allocations in the RAM, Denuvo detects the anomaly.
Oh, man.
The moment it realizes it is being observed by an unapproved process, it instantly terminates the application.
The book slams itself shut and bursts into flame.
Application terminated, right back to the console home screen. But this level of security introduces a very real engineering friction. Denuvo must strike a delicate balance here.
How so?
Well, it has to execute this incredibly complex, constantly shifting anti-piracy virtualization while simultaneously maintaining frame time stability for the player.
Ah, because if the processor is spending all its energy translating this polymorphic code, it's not rendering the graphics and my game starts stuttering.
Exactly. Which is exactly why gamers get frustrated by it sometimes.
Mm.
But from a purely defensive standpoint, it is a staggering piece of binary protection.
So put yourself in the shoes of a normal user. They are facing immutable hardware keys, physically burning fuses, and polymorphic anti-tamper software.
A formidable wall.
Right. Yet, despite all of this, people still go online, find a random sensationalized tutorial on a forum, and try to force their way in to jailbreak their console.
So what does this all mean? Why do they do it? And more importantly, what actually happens to the physical machine when they try?
Well, end users often view jailbreaking as just another software tweak, akin to, you know, installing a custom theme on a smartphone.
But it's not even close. They grossly underestimate the permanent structural toll that uncalibrated kernel exploits inflict upon complex system-on-chip architectures. We aren't talking about a software bug that a quick reboot will fix. We are talking about irreversible physical hardware destruction.
Wow. The dossier highlights three major failure cascades when someone tries a brute force exploit. The first one hits the NAND flash memory.
Yes.
Let's unpack this. A user injects an unstable payload directly into the kernel address space, the deepest part of the operating system. What happens next?
It induces a catastrophic kernel panic, an abrupt, unhandled crash at the absolute foundational level of the operating system.
And a crash at that level doesn't just freeze the screen, right? It sends a literal asynchronous voltage shock to the high-speed NVMe and NAND flash memory controllers.
To understand why that's fatal, you have to understand how flash memory works. It isn't a spinning disk. It is a microscopic grid of electrical cells.
Oh.
These cells rely on heavily calibrated, incredibly precise voltages to read and write data safely. To keep the drive healthy, the vendor uses wear-leveling algorithms.
Which is software that carefully distributes the read and write cycle so no single cell burns out too fast.
Exactly. But the kernel panic bypasses all of that. It completely blinds the safety systems. The asynchronous voltage shock blasts those microscopic cells with uncalibrated power.
Yikes.
It accelerates the degradation of the flash cells, corrupts the data blocks, and frequently results in an unrecoverable hardware brick. The storage drive is physically destroyed. You'd have to desolder and replace motherboard components to revive it.
So you've basically just fried your own hard drive.
You have.
But let's say the memory somehow survives. The second failure point the dossier mentions is thermal and voltage governance.
This one is brutal.
Modern console processors, the combined CPU and graphics chip, run incredibly hot. The system manages this by constantly polling thermal sensors, dynamically adjusting the voltage, and ramping the cooling fan up and down.
Right. It is a continuous, delicate feedback loop. But when a user tampers with the low-level system firmware, they often inadvertently strip away those vendor-calibrated thermal safeguards.
Oh, no.
The pulling loops that check the temperature degrade, or they fail entirely.
So the chip is playing a massive 4K game, generating enormous heat, but the software fails to tell the fan to spin faster.
The fan stays quiet while the silicon basically bakes itself. And this introduces the severe risk of BGA microsolder joint fractures.
BGA ball grid array.
Correct. It is the array of microscopic solder balls that physically connect the main processor to the motherboard.
Oh, okay.
When a chip experiences extreme, uncontrolled thermal cycling, so heating up massively and cooling down rapidly without fan governance, the silicon chip and the fiberglass motherboard expand and contract at different rates.
Oh, it's like pouring boiling water into a cold glass.
Exactly the same principle of thermal shock. Eventually, the physical stress fractures those microscopic solder joints. The connection between the brain of the console and the board is physically severed.
the chip literally breaks itself off the board. That is brutal.
It is irreversible physical damage.
And if you somehow avoid melting your motherboard, the third consequence isn't physical, but it is just as permanent. Automated telemetry.
The network death sentence.
Yes.
The console security processor is constantly monitoring the cryptographic hash integrity of the system. The millisecond an unverified kernel patch or unauthorized code injection is detected, the system flags its unique hardware console ID.
And it sends that flag directly to the central authentication clusters at Sony or Microsoft.
Triggering an irreversible hardware ban. It doesn't just ban your user account, it bans the physical silicon from ever accessing certified network services again.
Wow.
The secondary market value of the console drops to zero. It is effectively a pariah to the global network.
If we can go back to the car analogy from the beginning, this is basically like ripping out your car's engine control unit while driving 80 miles an hour down the highway just to see if you can bypass the speed limiter. But instead, you melt the engine block, blow the transmission, and permanently void your vehicle registration in all 50 states.
The physics of the hardware respond exactly how you would expect when deprived of their governance. It just breaks.
So, given everything we've just discussed, the melting solder joints, the fried memory, the permanent bans, why is there still such a passionate, vocal community advocating for the right to jailbreak these systems?
It's a great question.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because this brings us to a part of the dossier that I found incredibly compelling, because it elevates this from a technical argument to a cultural one.
The looming crisis of the year 2035.
Yes, the digital preservation dilemma. As the video game industry rapidly transitions toward all digital distribution and physical disc drives are inevitably phased out, a profound challenge emerges for historians and archivists.
Because if a game only exists as a digital download on a server, what happens when the company decides it's too expensive to keep that server running?
Right. We've already seen this happen. When the legacy PlayStation 3 store or the Xbox 360 marketplace faced shutdowns, people realized that hundreds of digital exclusive titles were about to vanish forever.
When the remote authentication servers eventually shut down, legitimate access to that interactive heritage is permanently extinguished.
Which puts us in a terrible catch-22. If I can't hack my own console to save these digital games because doing so will physically fry the motherboard and the cloud servers are turned off, aren't these pieces of art just doomed to disappear into the ether?
This raises an important question, and this is where the legal frameworks clash with computer science.
How so?
Well, archivists argue that copyright laws, such as the DMCA in the United States, are just too rigid. They argue for statutory exemptions specifically tailored for nonprofit museum archives.
Okay, I see.
The Tekken Report makes a very clear argument here. Society must draw a hard distinction between illegal software piracy, which is what Denuvo and Ifuzes are fighting, and legitimate digital preservation.
So the answer to saving gaming history isn't some rogue user in their basement running a volatile exploit script that might brick their console.
No, absolutely not. Relying on destructive consumer exploits is not a sustainable archival strategy. The solution is establishing standardized, legally certified institutional archiving protocols.
Like formal agreements.
Exactly. We need a framework recognized by international regulatory bodies that allows designated institutions like, say, the Strong National Museum of Play or the Video Game History Foundation to safely bypass DRM and archive the raw binaries before the servers go dark.
It is a fascinating tension. The very same silicon-level security mastery that protects developers from piracy today is the exact architecture that threatens to erase their work tomorrow if we don't build a legal off-ramp for archivists.
That is the paradox of modern digital security.
And I think that brings us to the core takeaway of this deep dive. The Tekken Game dossier proves that preserving the stock firmware on your console isn't just about being a good corporate citizen or following the terms of service.
Right.
It is a mathematically and physically sound strategy to protect a multi-hundred-dollar investment from irreversible silicon damage.
Technical literacy is your best defense. Once you understand the profound microscopic complexity of these systems, the desire to poke around blindly with an internet exploit script tends to just vanish.
Completely. But before we wrap up, I want to leave everyone with a thought that builds on this preservation dilemma.
Okay.
We learned today that modern consoles use completely immutable physical eFuses and silicon-level keys to prevent tampering. They are physically burned into the die.
Yes, permanently.
But let's fast forward 50 or 60 years. Even if museums finally get the legal right to preserve these consoles, what happens if the original manufacturers themselves go out of business?
Oh.
What if they simply lose the master cryptographic keys from their legacy vaults?
Mm-hmm.
Have we essentially engineered perfectly intact pieces of hardware that will become completely unbootable, mathematically locked plastic bricks for future digital archaeologists?
It is a chilling prospect. We may literally be building the most secure tunes in the history of media.
Something to ponder next time you boot up your system. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the Silicon Fortress of modern gaming. Keep questioning the technology you use every day, and we'll catch you on the next one.